Welcome to this latest edition of the Who's the One podcast, where we focus exclusively on Arizona's ultra-competitive 1st Congressional District. With Anita Malik, I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up in this episode, we'll talk with Jacob Rubashkin of Inside Elections. He was on our initial program to talk about how he was seeing the race overall. At the time, Inside Elections had the race as tilt Republican. It is still listed as tilt Republican. We'll ask Jacob why. We'll also get Anita's take on the impact of Mayor Kate Gallego's endorsement of Andre Cherney. All of that coming up on this edition of Who's the One.
Well, thank you, Jacob, for joining us again on Who's the One. I think you were on our first episode, I believe. So we appreciate you coming back to talk about what's happening with this race from the national perspective.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on.
One thing that stood out for me, and I was thinking about us chatting again, was when you were on before, we talked a lot about this was tilt Republican is how, you know, you had rated it. Looking today, I see it's still rated tilt Republican. But one of the things that you had mentioned that could sway it was if maybe a clear front runner came out of this mix. And now that we're so close to the primary here, what we're hearing, Steve and I, is that there's still a lot of undecided voters. Is there something different that you're seeing from that kind of national lens or polling that you've seen that maybe that's not true, that there is a front runner?
I think you hit the nail on the head here. I would not say that there's a front runner in this Democratic primary. I think that the dynamics have shifted and maybe some of the candidates that we thought would be stronger, not as strong and vice versa. But in terms of who is actually best positioned to win the primary, there's still a lot up in the air. And that has contributed to the stubbornness of the rating because Democrats are sitting around, national Democrats at least, and Arizona Democrats are sitting around not really knowing who they're going to be able to run against Schweikert. And that is a challenge, especially in a state like Arizona, which has such a late primary. It's a little earlier this year, right? It's not in August, it's in July, but it makes it more difficult to get a jump start on the general election. And if things were different, then maybe the rating would be different, but that's the way we see it right now.
Are you seeing any other race like this across the country with such a kind of people not making any decisions this late or not seeing a front runner on the Democratic side?
I am struggling to think of another primary, certainly on the Democratic side, that still features such uncertainty at this point in the election cycle. When you look at the other races that we have rated as similarly competitive, by and large, Democrats have been able to figure out who their nominee is already, either by the primary process in states that held earlier contests like California, or by a more natural or less democratic sorting process where the powers that be and other factors come into play to fall on a nominee before it even gets to the voters in a place like New Jersey's 7th, which at one point looked like it would be this very fractious primary fight, but everyone dropped out before things really got going. So the other thing that's going on, of course, is that in a lot of these competitive races, Democrats have returned candidates that were the nominee last cycle who came very close to winning. And so we see this in the neighboring Arizona 6th district, where former state senator Kirsten Engel is back for a rematch. She had a very tough primary last time. She had no primary this time. The 2022 nominee for this seat, of course, chose not to run again. The 2020 nominee chose not to run again. And so it was rare to begin with because there was no anointed successor. And it has continued to be, I would venture to say, probably the most fractious Democratic primary on the House side yet, or remaining.
Now, Jake, it was a differently drawn district, and Anita hates when I do this, but the 2018 nominee also chose not to run. So she chose to do a podcast instead. So that's...
I mean, a better decision in my book, at least. But
one thing we've discussed a lot, of course, is money. One of the candidates, Kurt Cromer, and self-serving plug here for a second, Jacob, I'm one of the co-moderators for a lot of the debates that happened here in Arizona. And so for the particular debate, Conor O'Callaghan sort of made a face when Kurt Cromer during the debate said, well, we're going to get Hakeem Jeffries said we're going to get $5 million. $5 million is going to come from the DCCC, regardless of who the nominee turns out to be. We did a follow-up and asked Connor about that, and his feeling was there may be some money that comes in. It may even be $5 million. We don't know, but it's going to take a lot more than that to ultimately win the race. Do you think money is going to be determined in both in terms of the amount that comes in, but also when it arrives and whether it arrives in time based on who the ultimate nominee is?
The short answer is there will probably be a lot of money in this district, regardless of who the nominee is, if only because none of these candidates are so objectionable to Democrats in DC, or I would venture to say voters on the ground, that their nomination would write off this race as a competitive opportunity. And that's typically when we see parties disengage from districts that should on paper be competitive, is when the nominee, for whatever reason, something happens and it's just they cut them off. We've seen that happen on the Republican side. J.R. Majewski is a good example in Ohio's 9th district. After he won that nomination, by all rights, that should have been a highly, highly competitive race last cycle. But because of his personal baggage, he didn't get any support from the National Party. He lost by double digits. Democrats, similar deal in Michigan's 10th district, Carl Marlinga, their nominee. So it does happen, but I don't see it happening in a district like this one. And look, we've already seen the National Party's on both sides put a stake in the ground here. We have the initial ad reservations, which can change and can be added to or subtracted from both the DCCC and House Majority PAC, which are the Democratic groups that are over $7 million in the Phoenix market. We've got Republican groups who have booked over $13 million in the Phoenix market. All signs point to an incredible level of investment from both national parties in this district. So, you know, I don't know what Jeffries did or didn't say, but I think it's pretty clear that Democrats and Republicans intend to spend a lot of money on whoever comes out of this primary because the district is so competitive.
This has been going a little bit of chatter on this, and we had a listener send us this as well, and a little chatter of this on Twitter, this idea of vote splitting because the primary field is so large. Can you talk to us or explain, first of all, just for our listeners, what that is?
So we see this in states that don't have runoff rules or minimum threshold requirements. Some states require a majority to win. Some states, like North Carolina, I believe the threshold is 30%. In Arizona, of course, you can win with a plurality. And so it's always a danger in a crowded field that one candidate could win with a smaller than normal percentage of the vote. Now, what I will say is that this is not a huge primary field. I mean, we have seen primary fields in House races that can stretch to a dozen candidates. And that's not just like a dozen candidates on the ballot. That's a dozen candidates who have current or previous elected experience, who have significant self-funding resources. And in those races, then we can see someone win with 25% of the vote, maybe. Or, you know, I think the lowest that I've seen in recent years, there was a race in Tennessee where I think that Diana Harshberger was the nominee. She won with like 18 or 19% of the vote. But when we're looking at this race, I mean, we've really got, depending on how you want to kind of tier out the primary, at most six, credible, funded, well-funded Democrats running for the nomination, and potentially fewer than that. I don't really think that it's so much of a danger unless you're looking for a candidate that's getting a majority of the vote. If you're looking for a majority and then six candidate field, you're probably not going to get it. But I wouldn't be surprised if the winner of this primary ends up with 25, 30% of the vote, 35, even if there's a kind of a late breaking development. And that's just, you know, it's a question of what a voter's tolerance is for how much support a nominee should have. In an ideal world, the nominee would be supported by every voter in the party, but that's not how we do things in American politics. So obviously a danger whenever you have more than, you know, three or four candidates, but I'm not quite sure that it will come into play here the way that it has in fields that are much larger.
Just because of perception for voters who, let's say, aren't paying as much attention, if someone ultimately wins this nomination with 29% of the vote, could that in any way be spun from a national standpoint of saying, well, you know, really, if you're that good a candidate, you should have at least pulled 40%. I mean, come on. So would that in any way affect national support potentially?
I don't think so, unless there was some sort of underlying reason for that. I do think that that is, it's more important what's going on under the hood than the final result. And so for some of these candidates, yeah, I mean, there are things out there that could take turns for the worse for some of these candidates. And those are the things that could affect how national groups approach this race. But I don't think that the mere fact of not getting 40% of the vote in a primary, I don't think that's enough to turn people off when a district like this one is so high on the target list for Democrats. They're going to go with who they've got here, regardless of what the primary result looks like.
How soon, Jacob, and I don't want to give away any of the secret sauce with what Inside Elections does, but moving away from Tilt Republican, when will you review it again? Will it be after the primary result is out and then you'll see, there's a person who has good name recognition, good history, good money, whatever the factors may be. There's, I presume, no chance in the next 6 weeks or so that you'll change that, or could you?
There's no set procedure, I guess. We have a way of doing things. We have a perspective. We have a history, but none of it is particularly set in stone. So we're not too precious to kind of stick with a rating no matter what, because that's what we've settled on before. It depends on a number of factors. I think one of the things that has made this district, frankly, a little bit harder to assess so far is because it is both a crowded Democratic primary, an uncertain primary, and a late primary, there has not been nearly as much research from either party on what the general election looks like. Because frankly, I think the general election will look differently depending on who the Democratic nominee is, and certainly the way the parties will approach it will look different. And when you're trying to formulate a campaign strategy and message strategy and things like that, the incentives to pull the race early on, pull a general election early on, are decreased when you're dealing with such a varied field on the Democratic side. So there is just not as much kind of general election information about this district as there is in, say, the 6th district, where we've known that this is going to be the matchup for quite some time. And so I think I feel a lot better about understanding what the general election dynamic is in that seat than I do about the 1st district. And so that's why, in large part, we've kind of kept it as a status quo. You know, I think once we get a primary nominee, everyone's going to come in and start polling the race. We're going to have another, you know, couple months of FEC filings under our belt. We'll be able to see, you know, which candidates are able to sustain a pace of fundraising, and you know, which candidate, you know, how much money does the eventual nominee exit the primary with. Schweikert doesn't have a ton of cash on hand, and so I think he is susceptible to being outspent. I think that's happened before for him. It hasn't meant that he's lost, but that's something that we look at too, kind of the relative, you know, financial resources of the two candidates. So, look, I think that it's probably not likely that we make a rating change before we know who the nominee is, but anything can happen, you know, and I wouldn't put it past Schweikert to have something come up on his side either that makes him potentially more vulnerable. We've seen how, you know, legal issues and campaign issues can intercede on his side in the past. And so it's up in the air, I guess, at the moment, but we'll see where the politics takes us.
Jacob Rabashkin of Inside Elections, great to talk with you again. Thanks for your insights from the national level on Who's the One.
All right. Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Anita, we have talked about endorsements, and some of them seem to mean something. Some of them don't seem to mean something. But one happened this week that when I saw it, I thought, wow, you know, considering we haven't seen any external polling yet, Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego endorsed Andre Cherney in a really personal way, too. Talked about how their kids had gotten to know each other, that they're both of Jewish background, that had bonded them to some extent as well. Seems like a very popular mayor of Phoenix, that could be something that does have an impact. First of all, do you think that's true? And any surprise, were you thinking about was there any buzz about who she might endorse that you had heard?
I'll start with the buzz. No, I hadn't heard anything. I think that a lot of people that have been kind of in the party infrastructure for many, many years do tend to favor Andre. So not a surprise that that's maybe where her personal alignment would be, but a surprise that she would publicly endorse. I think in a cycle where it is this crowded, a lot of people have been kind of leery of that, unless, again, they have that personal relationship. And I think you see that, you know, with some of the other endorsements in this race. So I think it's a big get for him. I think it's probably surprised a lot of people. And you're right, it was done in a very personal way, very different than other endorsements we've seen in this race, where, you know, you see the photo and say, I endorse this person, but, you know, she made a video. It was covered in the press quite a bit. And so it really, I think, probably gave him a little bit of a boost. Without polling, I'm the same as you, where I don't know if it's enough. I don't know if it's too late. I don't know if it'll get out to the undecided type of voters. Is it more the involved people that are seeing that and thinking, but I've already made up my mind? So it's hard to say at this point if it'll make much of a difference, but it is definitely a significant endorsement.
I'm going to put you on the spot in two ways here. Is there anyone else in the district that you would think is at Mayor Gallego's level that an endorsement from that person could make an impact? And considering it's a field of six, as we've talked about the entire life of this podcast, is there a certain percentage, like an endorsement from someone like Kate Gallego could make a 4% difference, which, you know, could actually affect the race? Is there, or are you thinking there isn't really anything that would, or anyone that would make enough to get someone over the hump? Even considering, as we said, we haven't seen the polls.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if I had to go with my gut instinct or venture a guess on that, I don't think any one single endorsement at this point, again, would be enough of a bump. But they all help, right? And we've said this before. I think what this comes down to me, and I feel like people don't believe me, but I really believe this, that it's going to come down to, in a six-way field, put aside the engaged activist voters who have already made up their minds, and let's look at that roughly 50 to 60% that everyone's saying are undecided. It's going to come down to, yes, maybe TV ads, but I think it's more the mailers in this race. And I think that because you have this opportunity to put those logos on there and put those names on there that are, you know, big. And there are definitely candidates that say, I have these, you know, big endorsements, I have unions, or I have these people. And everyone's kind of talking about that now, because when you are a voter that just doesn't know, you're going to research online, you're going to maybe look at what you get in the mail, and that's it. Like, that's how a lot of people will vote. And I just think it'll come down to that. So every endorsement, I think, helps at this point. Some definitely carry more weight. Hers carries more weight. Chris Mays carries weight. Is there anybody else, to answer your question? He won't endorse, but I think someone like Greg Stanton endorsing would be significant. But I really can't think of any other big names that, again, would also say, okay, well, now it's over. This is our front runner. That's not going to happen at this point. But I think everybody needs as much as they can get to kind of boost them at the tail end here.
Finally on this, would Democratic voters be wary of David Schweikert endorsing someone?
You still need to invite him on the podcast. That's all I'm going to say.
Yes,
there.
He would love that. All right, let's close out this edition of the podcast with, we had almost an entire episode devoted to signs and the importance of signs, yard signs. Mm-hmm. And you told me that in your neighborhood, you've seen some more signs popping up.
But not the kind of signs you want to see if you're Anita Malik. Okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of David Schweikert, we just said this. Good segue there, Steve. I, for the last couple of cycles, very aware of where I see whose signs where, in my neighborhood at least. I'm on the board of the HOA. I know the neighborhood. There's always been one house that's had a Schweikert sign. I've let it be. It's one sign. That is not the case this time. There are four houses that have those tiny, you know, I don't know if you've seen his yard signs, but they're very little, very, very small. And that's concerning to me because I'm not seeing any of the Democratic candidate signs in my HOA, in surrounding areas that I drive through to get to the main roads. I've not seen one. I've seen them on the streets. You know, people are using their yard signs as street signs, but not in somebody's yard. And we've talked about this. The yard signs make a difference. You know, hopefully that will shift in the general where my street is full of those, but I'm not seeing it now. And again, I think this points to that indecision, this maybe lack of not being interested, because it just is exhausting. Every neighbor I talked to was like, it's that deep sigh. Who do I vote for? Who are the people running? Like, it's that, it's still happening. And so the signs to me are telling. And this is, do you have time, Steve, for one of my Anita stories?
Oh my God, of course. Does it involve someone you're eating dinner with friends and there was someone that you yelled at from your car to get?
I didn't know. As good as that one. This story.
Well, no. I mean, and I want to correct myself. You weren't yelling, you were projecting so the person could hear you, but yes.
No, so speaking of his sign, my 10-year-old, who in past cycles, people that have really followed me know that I'll put up like politics with Wade, you know, because he'll make these comments, he'll watch YouTube videos, and then the political ads come on, and he always tells me what he thinks. And a little bit, you know, old soul for his age, but he just came to me 2 days ago, and I was like, Mom, did you notice that on the Schweikert signs? And I said, notice what? And he said, he's using the star and the swoosh. I'm like, I don't know what you mean. He's like, there's a star over the eye. And I'm like, okay. He's like, you had that. I'm like, I did. And he's like, he didn't have that before. I'm like, are you sure? He said, yes. So then he said, there's a swoosh too now, but that's newer. I'm like, are you sure? And he said, yours has a swoosh too. I'm like, it did? I don't, you know, when you see something so much, you don't notice that. So I went back. So when I was walking around the neighborhood, I did see his newest sign has both a star and a swoosh. Last cycle, I'm assuming it was last cycle, because he saves his signs. He's notorious for that. So he can add to the volume, was just a star. And so I looked at my logo today because my 10-year-old cannot get over this. It's very, he gets fixated on this and it's like driving around. And he's right. I have a star and a swoosh. So it has been co-opted by David Schweikert. And I'm just upset about that. So I'd like to see some Democratic signs. I don't care which of the six get into my neighborhood. I will say Clearview Precinct. That's my tip, guys. That's my end of my rant.
So I was thinking that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. But is it more like imitation is the sincerest form of condescension in this case?
Good one. I have nothing to say.
Thanks for listening to Who's the One. To get in touch with us, email az01podcast@gmail.com. That's az01podcast@gmail.com. Anita is on X @AnitaMalik, and you can find me on X @OffCenterVoice. And to find our past episodes, please go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts and search for Who's the One. Music for this podcast provided by Epidemic Sound. For former congressional nominee Anita Malik, I'm Steve Goldstein.